Well, hello everyone, greetings, and welcome to the teleclass, Healthcare-Associated Infection Surveillance in Long-Term Care. Now, in past years, and to a certain extent in this year, our teleclass schedule has had a very acute care focus. But increasing pressure from many of you who are listening, in fact, in the long-term care community has pushed us to include more lectures on topics that are of unique interest to your practice. So hopefully next year we'll have even more still, but I'm really pleased to bring you one of my favorites today, and one of the ones that's oft requested. Earlier this year, during the series that we did specifically for novices, Mary Andrus gave a tremendous presentation on surveillance. It was really popular, and she was very popular. You might have heard me say earlier, if you were on a little earlier, that we have a very large audience from Brazil today who may not be listening to us live, but who registered for the teleclass because they know of Mary's work. I asked her back to give this presentation on infection surveillance specifically for long-term care. She is a great one to do it. Mary works at the CDC in Atlanta, and her work in the field of infection surveillance has made her an expert, and I'm so pleased that she's able to join us again today. So to present the teleclass, Healthcare-Associated Infection Surveillance in Long-Term Care from the CDC in Atlanta, I am pleased to present Mary Andrus. Mary.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with this group again. And I want to point out something on the very first slide, that my title is changed now from Infection Control Professional to Infection Preventionist. And this is the language that we are using in our particular discipline now. And I think it speaks much more clearly to the work that we do. So I'm very happy to be here with you this afternoon, and I'm hoping that we'll have, over the course of the next 30 or 40 minutes, we'll have a chance to take a look at surveillance activities in the long-term care, the nursing home facility. We have both acute care. We know that acute care hospitals and long-term care facilities have populations that require nursing care, and that they are both subject to hospital-associated infections or healthcare-associated infections. But each of these populations is very unique, and the patients or the residents, as they're identified in the long-term care setting, have some very unique attributes which makes them more susceptible to certain infections and not as likely to develop other infections that we might see in the hospital. So let's go to the next slide, and we'll begin to look at our objectives for the presentation this afternoon. So first, we want to just take a look at the components of a surveillance system. What should a surveillance system for healthcare-associated infections in a nursing home or long-term care facility look like? Next, we want to list the most common infections that are identified in long-term care, and we'll actually take a look at sort of how the infection definitions are written and how they need to be interpreted. We'll review the formulations that are used for calculating healthcare-associated infection rates in the long-term care setting, and then we'll look a little bit more closely at what's the purpose, what's the point here, and how will we use the surveillance data to improve patient outcomes. The next slide. When we look at the components of a long-term care facility, I think it's important to take a look at the literature. And I have a citation here at the bottom from the American Journal of Infection Control, and this is actually called Infection Prevention and Control in the Long-Term Care Facility Setting. And this is really sort of the sentinel document that we use when we're trying to figure out what are the important pieces of an infection prevention program in the nursing home. The facility should have a system for ongoing collection of data on infections in the facility, and I think that's why we're all here today, because we recognize that. Some of the elements that should be included in the surveillance program in long-term care include standardized definitions, identification of the population at risk, sort of a determination of what the data sources should be for data collection, what are the numerators and what are the denominators, and how do we put them together to get information about patient care. And finally, we'll talk just a little bit about what the reports need to look like that we're going to put together and submit to leadership in long-term care. Next slide. The infection control professional should review the surveillance data frequently and make recommendations about infection prevention measures in response to the identified problems. So when we say that the data should be reviewed frequently, this means it's no fair sitting down at the end of the year and taking a look at all the patient charts and counting the numbers of infections. The reason for the surveillance data is to recommend infection prevention measures and see that these infection measures become implemented. The infection rates should be calculated periodically. They should be recorded and reported to those who can make a difference. So keep in mind that the infection preventionist is not the individual who actually puts their hands on the patients, although in some of the smaller facilities that actually may be the case. This infection preventionist might be the charge nurse or the assistant director of nursing or one individual like this. But more importantly is this information about the rates and about the occurrence of infections in our long-term care facilities should be reported on a fairly frequent basis to those people who can actually make a difference. Something that I mentioned, I know, when I did the similar talk for the acute care setting is this is not just about collecting the numbers. Surveillance for the sake of collecting numbers should be discontinued. There's absolutely no point in just collecting the numbers. It has to be a good reason for doing this, and that reason should be improving patient outcomes. Next slide. So how will we then identify infections in the nursing home or the long-term care setting? And we're going to call these facility-associated infections, and actually it's a healthcare-associated infection, but for our purposes, it's an infection where there's no evidence that the infection was present or incubating on admission or readmission, and no evidence that the infection began as the result of a procedure that was carried out in an acute care hospital or the physician's office or clinic. So basically, we're trying to sort of ratchet down where the acquisition of this infection took place whenever we can, and see if we can't associate an identified infection with the long-term care setting. The majority of the infections that we identify are definitely going to be associated with the facility. They will be infections, HAIs, that are attributed to the long-term care facility. The frequency of surveillance in the long-term care should be at least once a week, and in the acute care setting we would say it needs to be every day or at least two or three times a week. But in long-term care we realize that resources perhaps are more limited yet, but this still shouldn't be cast aside. It's very important to have surveillance that takes place at least once a week. The next slide. So when we take a look at infections, it's important to sort of, you know, what are our benchmarks? What do we compare to? And the reality of the situation is that we really don't have any national comparative rates. We'll talk a little bit later about public reporting and the fact that there's a lot of talk about making reporting from nursing homes required in certain states. But at this point in time, there really are no comparative data upon which to draw. So we've seen in the published literature, we've seen lots of different concepts, and we've seen rates that range anywhere from 2.6 HAIs per 1,000 resident days to 7.1 infections in this population. And some sources suggest that sort of a rule of thumb is that in a given nursing home, you will have an average of one infection per resident per year. Next slide. So what kind of infections are we looking at when we're talking about long-term care facilities? We, those of us that are in the long-term care milieu, understand that urinary tract infections, which are associated with catheters, are relatively common. Respiratory infections, infected pressure ulcers, gastroenteritis, and conjunctivitis are probably the most common. We do see some of these infections that occur in more or less outbreak situations. Most especially we'll see respiratory infections during flu season, especially we'll see outbreaks of influenza, and then also gastroenteritis. There have been any number of reports of norovirus and other such gastrointestinal bugs that have sort of whipped through a nursing home and in this particular really highly immunocompromised patient population. We'll take a little bit closer look at some of these infections in just a minute. Okay, let's look at the next slide. So where will we get our data? Where will we collect the information? What are the sources that we need to look at? Well, first of all, we need to be talking with our staff, primarily the nursing staff, although you may have podiatry staff, there may be some wound staff, people that other individuals that come in, respiratory services and so forth. So talk with the staff, find out where your infections are, who's taking care of the patients, and what kinds of things they're seeing in the resident population. It's a good idea to make walking rounds. Go to your nursing units. Take a look not only at what patients might have infections. You can maybe see the temperature chart and so forth, but take a look also while you're there. Take a look at the infection prevention practices that you see. Do we see people using gloves appropriately? Do we see, most importantly, of course, hand hygiene being applied in all the situations where we know it should be? It's important to take a look at the medical progress note in the patient record. We don't, of course, have the frequency of medical staff progress notes that we do in the acute care hospital, but you need to always take a look at those notes to see, you know, have there been new things reported to the physician? Has the physician made a note about patient signs and symptoms? Has the physician been called for one reason or another for a given patient? You can look also at lab or radiology reports. We know that these microbiology, for example, and radiology services are not as readily available in the long-term care setting as they are in the acute care hospital. But when these are available, they certainly should be reviewed during the surveillance process. Medication records, of course, can be valuable. It's very important to take a look at who's getting antimicrobials. And so when you identify a resident with an antimicrobial agent that's new, take a look, see why, see what the physician order says, see what the nursing staff, how and when the nursing staff notified the physician and so forth. And then a really important source of information that I realize is deficient in many ways is the transfer record that you get from the acute care hospital or from the rehab setting or hospice or from whatever situation this patient came. There should be good information on that transfer record. If it's not there, try to chase it down. If you call that hospital floor back in acute care two or three times, you know, the chances of you getting better records the next time go up. I realize that this is a real issue, but at the same time, it's important for the long-term care facility to document information about infections, about medications, about lab and radiology reports to the acute care hospital or rehab center or other institution whenever the patient is transferred from your facility back to another type of healthcare institution. Okay, so the next slide. We're going to talk just a little bit about surveillance definitions in long-term care or criteria. What do the definitions look like? The acute care definitions aren't used in long-term care. And in 1991, there's a document that many of us refer to as the McGeer definitions. And the reference for that, for those definitions and that document is at the bottom of this particular slide. These definitions were written by a Canadian consensus group in 1991, and even though there's not a definitive study about the definitions, they are widely used in long-term care surveillance, and for the most part, people are satisfied with them. We'll talk just a little bit more about why they seem to be effective definitions. As I already mentioned, there are no established benchmarks for long-term care surveillance data. Nothing for national comparison at any rate. But I think one of the things we'll talk about when we look at reports and writing data is that it's more important for your facility to compare your data to your own data over time. Are you getting better? Are your infections increasing? You know, in which areas are you deficient? Which areas do you need more work? The other thing to identify about the surveillance definitions in long-term care is that there is no risk classification involved, only at the level of the infection. So when we talk about a gastroenteritis, the patients who are more profoundly immunized, for example, are not separated in the data from those that are not so severely immunocompromised. Next slide. So I'll just restate the obvious that acute care definitions or the CDC definitions that we speak about are not definitions that should be used in long-term care. And there are lots of reasons for this. One of the primary ones is that the nursing home population and the nursing home facility doesn't have access to the microbiology laboratory and the radiology services and even the serology areas that acute care hospitals do. And they don't have clinicians on staff who are in the facility all the time writing progress notes and collecting this type of data. So it's not appropriate to use those CDC definitions in the long-term care setting. In the McGeer document, it's stated that all symptoms that are identified must be new symptoms or acutely worse. We're looking for the incidence of infection. We don't want to keep counting the same old infections over and over again. Chronic symptoms aren't used, and it's just important to identify that a urinary tract infection that you had last week is not a new urinary tract infection if the original infection didn't go away. So just because you've maybe grown a new bug, maybe you have a new microorganism that's been identified in the urine out of culture or whatever, it's not necessarily a new infection unless the infection that you identified 2 weeks ago has been relieved, unless there's some indication that the patient has gotten better. It's also very important to consider non-infectious causes for the signs and symptoms that you identify before you consider the infectious symptoms. So when a patient has, for example, a cough, it's important to rule out, you know, COPD and some other possible chronic conditions and respiratory pre-existing conditions before you jump to the conclusion that it might be an infection. Identification shouldn't be based on a single piece of evidence. It's important to use all of the elements of the criteria that are listed in the surveillance definition. So if it calls for the patient has a fever and certain symptoms, then the fever has to be there and the symptoms have to be there. You can't just choose one or the other. And then when the physician makes a diagnosis, it should always be accompanied by compatible signs and symptoms of the infection. So in other words, if the physician has documented perhaps in the progress note that the patient is septic, you can't just record a bloodstream infection. You have to find some evidence that the patient actually has a bloodstream infection, whether it's microbiology data or signs and symptoms data. Next slide. So this is just a list of the definitions that are included in the McGeer document, in the surveillance definitions document. And for respiratory infections, there's a definition for the common cold, influenza-like illness, pneumonia, other respiratory tract infection. For urinary tract, there are definitions for all UTIs, or data are collected, I should say, for all UTIs and for catheter-associated urinary tract infections. There's a definition for gastroenteritis. There are four definitions for EENT, conjunctivitis. I apologize for the little typo there. It's not conjunctivitis. Ear infections, mouth infections, and sinusitis. Under skin, we have cellulitis, soft tissue and wound infection, fungal infection, herpes infections, and scabies. And under systemic, you have primary bloodstream infection and fever of undetermined origin. So there are many different infection types, HAI types to choose from, and we'll kind of look at how that sort of falls together in the report when we get to that part. Okay, so on the next slide, we're just going to take a look at an example of an infection definition and sort of how this needs to be interpreted in order to follow the definition. So this is just the definition of gastroenteritis, and this comes directly from this definitions document. And so in order for a patient to meet the definition of gastroenteritis, one of the following criteria must be met. First, two or more loose or watery stools above what is normal for the resident within a 24-hour period, or two or more episodes of vomiting in a 24-hour period, or both of the following: A, a stool culture that's positive for a pathogen, or a toxin assay that's positive for C. difficile toxin, and B, at least one symptom or sign compatible with gastrointestinal tract infection, either nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, or tenderness and diarrhea. So you can see you can choose one, either number one, number two, or number three. And if you choose number three, then you have to have both A and B. So that just sort of shows you how those definitions are laid out and how they need to be followed. So if you have a patient, for example, that has a positive C. difficile toxin, but that's it, that's all you've got, it does not meet the definition. It does not meet definition number three. So you can't record that until you can find those signs or symptoms that are compatible with that gastrointestinal tract infection. Okay, to the next slide. Other things that need to be considered when you're reviewing patient records and patients for healthcare-associated infections. Radiology and microbiology data are less available. We've already talked about that. And the detection of infections often depends on the recognition of clues by nursing assistants, nursing techs, and are reported then to the licensed staff. So you're sort of getting secondhand information, and sometimes it's important to go back and sort of validate that infection with other information. And keep in mind also that positive cultures do not necessarily signify an infection. For example, you may do active surveillance testing for MRSA in your long-term care facility, but because a patient has MRSA in their nares does not mean that they have an MRSA infection. Anywhere, they may just be colonized with MRSA. Also, if there's a surgical site infection in the patient, in the resident, then the acute care definition should be used because we don't do surgery in the long-term care facility venue. And then when you use that acute care CDC definition, it should be reported to the hospital where the operation was done, and it will be counted with the procedure information by that hospital. It won't be counted by the long-term care facility. And then the other point to make is that influenza is reported only during flu season, so between the months of October and March, including October and March. Next slide. So when we look at rates, it's important not to do analysis on absolute numbers. It's misleading to just say, well, we had four common colds this month, and we have nine the month before. So we've had a wonderful decrease, and that's not appropriate. It's more important to calculate rates. And so how we do this is to identify a numerator and a denominator. We'll look at the formulas in just a minute. So the numerator for your infection rates will be the number of healthcare-associated infections that are identified by definition type and those that are device-associated. So you can do it either or both. For example, if you were to look at the numerator for urinary tract infections, you could look at all urinary tract infections in your numerator. So you would identify all residents who met the criteria, the definition for a UTI. Or you could look and identify only those infections that were in residents who had an indwelling urinary catheter. So that would be the device associated. So again, you can look at the number of infections by the whole patient population or by those patients who have a specific device. And then for the denominator, you always look at the population at risk. So if you were looking at overall infection rates for a given category of or a given definition, you would use the number of resident days in the denominator. And if you were looking at device-associated infections that we like we just described with catheter-associated UTI, you would look at device days in your denominator. Now, for the calculation of resident days and device days, this means that every day you would count the number of residents in the facility and add those numbers up at the end of the month, and that would give you the total number of resident days for that month. For device days, you would look at the specific device, and primarily in long-term care we're talking about indwelling urinary catheters, although we do see ventilators used from time to time, and we also see central lines that are used occasionally. So by device type, you would every day count the number of residents with the device and then add that number at the end of the month, and that would be the number that would be used in the denominator. Next slide. So let's just take a peek at what these formulas look like. In the top box, we see the incidence rate, and this is actually the formula for the incidence rate. It's the number of new healthcare-associated infections, and this is by infection type. So let's just say we're looking at, as the example below shows, the number of cases of influenza in January. The number of new HAIs divided by the number of resident days times 1,000. So in the example, we have 8 new cases of influenza in January divided by 980, which is the number of resident days, and then we multiply that number by 1,000, and it gives us 8.16. Next slide. So if we're looking instead of just by specific infection type, if we're looking at device-associated infections and the rates are calculated by the number of device-associated infections divided by the number of device days times 1,000. And again, this will be by facility. In other words, for a given month. So in the example, we have identified in our long-term care facility 2 residents with a catheter-associated urinary tract infection, and we divided that by 188 indwelling catheter days. We multiply by 1,000, and our rate for that month is 10.63. Next slide. So it's important that we pull together some of this data and we prepare a report. And the report is usually done monthly, quarterly, and annually to identify trends. Now I have to tell you that monthly reporting, you may be dealing with very small numbers. And so it may not be quite so useful to you to pull those data together on a monthly basis. You may find that it's a little more meaningful to have data that's calculated by the quarter, and I had included some a sample of a report that demonstrates what those data look like, and we'll actually take a look at that next on the next slide. So this is just sort of a shot. On the left, you can see a table, and it is just a partial table of the infection report that I included in your handouts for healthcare-associated infection report. And as you can see here, we're looking at the first quarter. On the purple column, you can see the totals for the first quarter. This includes all the data from January, February, and March totaled in the column called quarter one. And so what we've done is we have put together, as you can see, there were a total of 23 respiratory infections during the first quarter, and that was, you can see, that was comprised of 12 patients who had a common cold, 9 who had influenza-like illness, 1 who had a pneumonia, and 1 that had an other RTI, respiratory tract infection. So altogether, there were 23 patients, and if I took that number and I divided it by the number of resident days, which actually turned out for the first quarter to be 1,352, then I get a rate of 17. Similarly, for urinary tract infection below, now I've calculated this two different ways. I've identified UTIs in my whole patient population, and I also identified catheter-associated UTIs in my patient population. If you look in the row called UTI, you can see that I didn't have any patients who had just a urinary tract infection who did not have a catheter during this particular quarter. Another quarter, I certainly could see that. But I had a total for the first quarter of 4 residents who had a catheter-associated UTI. I've also put together the number of catheter days, which in this facility was 305. So if I divide 4 by 305 and multiply by 1,000, I get 13.1 catheter-associated UTIs per 1,000 catheter days. And then I've also created just a little run chart on the right that gives me some idea what are my trends in my facility. You know, are my healthcare associated infection rates stable? Are they going up? Are they going down? And this is actually a total. Unlike in acute care, it's relatively common to calculate an overall HAI infection rate for the facility. And I did this one by month, and I can see that, you know, I'm making some progress. And, you know, perhaps this is associated with the time of year, because as the time goes by, the weather gets better, influenza season is gone, and so maybe my rates are going down for that reason. But I'll follow this over time just to see what I get. Okay, so let's look at the next slide. And those of you who know me understand that this is the most important point to make, that it's not about collecting the numbers. It's not even about sending the reports to the leadership in your nursing home. It's important to interpret this data so that it's meaningful to the audience. Turn it into information. Turn these numbers into something that's useful in your resident population. Next slide. So in the example that I gave you before, this particular message might be that for our patients who have a Foley catheter, we're doing a better job of preventing urinary tract infections. And we can maybe explain this by the fact that our catheter days has decreased. So if I look in the row called catheter days down close to the bottom, you can see that I started out in January with 110, then I dropped down to 101, and went then in March to 94. So my overall use of indwelling urinary catheters has gone down, and that might be a reason why my infection rate seems to be getting better. I think it's always important, unless your rate is zero, to keep driving home the point that we can do better. We can decrease these infections in our resident population. Next slide. So when do we report externally? When do we report these data outside our hospital or any data outside our hospital? We've just sort of talked about what we should collect for our internal process improvement, but what should we report externally? Well, we've already said that if you identify any complications of surgical procedures, you need to report that back to the hospital where the operation was done. You need to always report any important infections or infectious information to the facility where you're transferring, to which you're transferring the resident. For example, if you identify through any methodology that this patient is colonized with MRSA, that should be reported to the hospital, to the doctor's office, to the dentist's office, wherever the resident goes for care. That information should go with the resident. It's always and obviously important to report epidemiologically significant infections to the public health authority. If you are one of the unlucky ones that has that nasty little outbreak of norovirus or influenza, it's very important to report that information to your local public health department. And then finally, you know, I sort of alluded to this earlier, that mandatory public reporting could very well be on the horizon for long-term care. We at CDC have been hearing some interesting comments from not only state governments but at the federal level as well, that they think it's important for healthcare associated events, whatever type they be, including infections, should be reported publicly. So this would mean that if indeed this legislation at any level were to occur, if it were either in your state or at the federal level, that there would be either a website or a journal article or something where the public could actually look up your long-term care facility and identify the rates of infection, either very specific rates of infection for device-associated infections or for specific type of infection, and compare it to another kind of nursing home. So this could be something that's important for not only for marketing but for just, you know, public relations in general. Next slide. So we've talked about monitoring some outcome information. And by outcome, we mean what happens to patients, what patients wind up with infections, and what those rates look like. But it's also important to monitor sometimes process measures. And so I think I've included a few of those on this list. So in addition to patient infections and resident infections, it may be important also to monitor patient and staff influenza vaccination rates. We know that influenza can be a killer in the long-term care setting, and so it's not just the patients and the staff that need to be immunized, but it's also the volunteers, it's the medical staff, it's the respiratory therapists, it's all the people that come in and out of that facility who are potentially infectious to the residents in the facility. You may also want to monitor blood and body fluid exposures. It's an easy thing to do because you have to identify them in your staff, in your nursing staff, and in your other staff when it occurs. So it's just as easy to collect the numbers as they come in and use. You can either use a denominator or you can split that up by staff type. For example, you can create a rate of infection for your nursing assistants, or a rate of exposure for your nursing assistants, rate of exposure for your physicians, and so forth. And then there are process monitors that are important. For example, hand hygiene, dressing changes, indwelling catheter care. Hand hygiene in particular is incredibly important. I think that all of us recognize that that compliance with hand hygiene is the single most important thing that we can do for our residents in long-term care as well as in acute care. So find a way to measure hand hygiene compliance. Either have what we call secret shoppers, which are individuals that, you know, you may pick a visitor, for example, and find a way to have that visitor just do some observations about when people wash their hands, and did they do it before they touched the patient? Did they do it after they touched the patient? Did they perform hand hygiene, for example, when they fed the resident, and so forth? So those are very important things, and then give feedback to the nursing and other professional staff about how they did. You know, how many of you think that we're washing our hands correctly, and look for a show of hands, and I promise you, you'll have 90% of the people in the audience will raise their hands. And then when you tell them that, you know what, we had someone actually watching you, and you in reality only washed your hands about 35% of the time in an appropriate way. So that kind of feedback to caregivers is incredibly important. And then finally on my list is antimicrobial use, and this is becoming more and more important in long-term care. There are, as we all know, an enormous amount of antimicrobial use and abuse in this patient population. It's the laboratory facilities are not as available as they are in acute care, and sometimes the most expedient thing to do is to, when a patient is identified as having signs and symptoms of infection, to administer antimicrobials. And it's good to identify the extent of antimicrobial use. It's also very important to monitor antimicrobial resistance in this population. And sometimes you can put the two together. You know what? We are using, you know, this to this degree, we're using third-generation cephalosporins, and we're also, you know, 6 months later identifying that our resident population are becoming increasingly, their microorganisms are becoming increasingly resistant to these agents. So, and I think we're seeing this, our colleagues in pharmacy, our colleagues in laboratory are finding these trends, and they're beginning to become very interested in what those trends look like. Next slide. So let's just sort of pull it all together and say basically that the surveillance data that's collected in long-term care focuses primarily on outcomes. We do know that it's important to identify what are the rates of infection and the different kinds of infection in the long-term care population. Surveillance has objective definitions that are specifically designed for long-term care. And finally, it's important that these surveillance data are used to plan prevention activities and educational activities and to prevent outbreaks in the long-term care setting. So that's what I have to say to you. I want to thank each of you for participating this afternoon, and I will be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mary, thank you very much. That's a lot of stuff. I was hoping you might touch on one thing. I don't know if you can, but I'm going to give you the question anyway. When you have an outbreak in a long-term care facility and it gets into the media and there's this firestorm of bad press and hysteria, how do you go about explaining the scientific significance of surveillance in the midst of that firestorm?
Well, first of all, I'm sort of a proponent of transparency. I think it's important to, you know, let the media know about these things up front rather than having somebody find out. But the surveillance, you know, in this particular situation, and it's difficult. You have to use plain language. You have to explain things in the most simple terms possible and don't second guess the questions they might ask. Just volunteer the information. And, you know, say, you know, these people, this is their home. These individuals, these residents in this nursing home, live here. They share living spaces. They eat in the same eating areas. We don't restrict their activities unless we know that there's an identified problem. And I just think that it's important to help to put things in that perspective for the public, because there's always the perception that somebody just was terribly lax in their techniques, in their aseptic techniques, and they tend to think, the public tends to think of a long-term care facility as a hospital. And so that distinction needs to be made, that these people live here, that by pretty much by definition, this is a place for rehabilitation and a place for living. And so people make contact with each other, and when we find out these situations, we jump in and we take all the measures that we know are necessary to prevent the further spread of an organism. But it's a very tough issue in a nursing home. It's a tough issue in an acute care hospital as well as in a rehab facility or home health or anything else. It's a very tough situation when we have an outbreak and it becomes public. Yeah, and sometimes the more dramatic events sell better than those that are just, you know, epidemiology is boring. You know, I'll be the first one to say that right out loud.
Thank you all for joining us. And Maria, thank you again for another tremendous teleclass presentation.
It's my pleasure.
So we'll talk to you all again very soon. Goodbye.